Dirty Bird Podcast contains foul language and is not appropriate for young fledglings. Listener discretion is advised. Our intro music is brought to you by Ricky Pistone, aka Dick Piston. And our outro music is brought to you by the Sidewalk Slammers. Check them out wherever you get your music.
Are you looking for a podcast today? With ornithology and humor you crave. Well, I know all these guys and it's birds they like. It's Dirty Bird. Yeah, they're just a couple guys who really like birds. It's Dirty Bird. Yeah, they're pretty dirty, but they really like birds.
Hello, and welcome to Dirty Bird Podcast, a podcast that's serious about birds, but nothing else. I'm Dr. John, and in each episode, I talk about an individual bird species. I read all the scientific articles, so you don't have to. Today, I'll be talking about the white-throated swift. Shout out to Charlie for recommending this species. Charlie also provided some pictures of white-throated swifts he took at the American River in Sacramento, and that's the cover picture for this episode. Check it out. Also, quick apologies to anyone who has recommended I cover a species and I haven't yet. I get a lot of requests, and so sometimes I lose track of, you know, episodes that I'm planning to do. So if it's been a while and I haven't covered your species, please, please reach back out. I'll be happy to research and do an episode on them. Also, thanks to Charlie for alerting me that the t-shirt website was down. I've actually revamped the Dirty Bird Podcast t-shirts. I've created a bunch of new t-shirt designs. All the designs are drawn by the very talented TJ Ranosky. By the way, TJ's artwork has been taking off. He's been displayed in art galleries in New York City and London. I'm really lucky to have an internationally famous artist doing the t-shirt design for my little podcast. So yeah, definitely check him out. There's some really cool designs, and they're very reasonably priced. So thanks to everyone who gets a t-shirt. All proceeds go to, you know, supporting the show. And if anyone is interested in any free Dirty Bird Podcast stickers, just reach out to me. You can find the t-shirts using the link in the episode description. Also, I have this link posted on the Dirty Bird Podcast Facebook page, Instagram page. Feel free to email me too at dirtybirdpodcast@gmail.com if you're having any kind of trouble, or even to, you know, request like a different t-shirt design. Hey, I want this logo on the front and this one on the back. Yeah, sure. I gotcha. Today, I'm recording from First Landing State Park. I'm in a little bit of a different spot that I'm pretty excited about. You may have heard that Carolina wren calling at the beginning of the episode. If you listen to my chicken episode, I have a little story about that family of Carolina wrens. They might not like me too much. But I did find a pretty sweet little spot. I'm actually kind of recording on an island in the swamp in First Landing right now. It is technically off trail, not very far off trail. I just kind of walked over some fallen down trees to cross over the water, and I'm sitting on said fallen down trees, and it's just a really cool, peaceful spot. As always, since I'm recording from First Landing, you know, there probably will be some jet and traffic noise. Oh well, it's, you know, the best I can do in Virginia Beach. But hopefully we get some good bird noises. There's usually a bunch of squirrel tree frogs calling away too around here, so hopefully we pick up some good sounds. I also have a quick story too I'd like to tell. So I've been working at the VA Medical Center in Hampton, Virginia. It's actually situated on a pretty cool spot, right where the Hampton Roads Bridge Tunnel is. It's right where the James River hits the Chesapeake Bay, and there's a part of it where they have a little area kind of cordoned off, and it's for veterans to be able to come in and, you know, fish from the shore there. So sometimes if I have some free time at work, I'll kind of go walk out there if the weather's nice. And while I'm walking out there, I've been observing that there's a blue heron that will just come and hang out walking around like the grass where all these people are fishing. And like pretty fearless of humans. Like, I'm not used to blue herons being like this. And I mean, I was like, at first I'm like, people are probably, you know, feeding him extra bait or something like that, you know. But this blue heron, I noticed when someone catches a fish, he like knows, he can see the pole bend, I guess, and he knows that they're catching a fish, and so he'll run up to them, and like as they reel in the fish, you know, usually it's like it's a small little croaker or something like that. And you know, I guess some people have caught fish before and then just like thrown them to him to eat. So he like knows when people catch a fish, he reels it in, he's like, huh, you want to throw it in the water, you want to throw to my beak, come on. I didn't see anybody actually feeding him, which is, you know, good. You shouldn't be feeding you know, birds like that, getting them dependent on humans. But I thought it was very smart of the heron to be able to notice when a pole was bending and a fish was on the line. All right, well, let's go ahead and jump into talking about the white-throated swift. This episode may be on the shorter side. As we'll learn, the white-throated swift is a fast-moving bird that nests in very hard-to-access areas, making it a pretty difficult bird to study. There weren't a lot of research articles out there about white-throated swifts, but I read through them all that I could find, and here's all the scientific information about this bird. And I want to begin this actually talking about a personal experience that probably captures a lot of people's, you know, feelings when they see white-throated swift. So I was at Big Bend National Park like a year or two ago with my wife. We did some backpacking out there. And on our last day, as we were like finishing up a loop, we summited Emery Peak. It's just shy of 8,000 feet tall. I think it's the highest peak in Big Bend National Park. It's a little bit of a strenuous hike to it. Like, it just gets more and more kind of steep and steep. And then to actually get to the very, very peak of it, you do have to, like, do some rock climbing to get up there. So you really have to rock climb, you know, up these 10, 15, 20-foot vertical rock surfaces to get to the very top. And once you're up there, you're like, the white-throated swifts are just flying around, and they are flying so low, they are like zipping past your heads like bullets. Like, I was worried one of them was going to hit me and impale me. But they were so cool to watch, just so acrobatic, effortless in their flying. And it was so cool, so breathtaking to see them like that. And that's what most people will notice when they look at these birds. They're very quick. They move through the air as, you know, as if they're fish swimming through water. They're highly social birds, so they're usually seen in groups. Usually if you see one, they're accompanied by other ones. As far as what they look like, they're the typical swift body shape. I always think of swifts as cigars with wings. They have this tubular shape to their body and then these long tapered wings. The white-throated swift specifically is on the larger side for swifts. It's bigger than a sparrow, but smaller than a robin. Their wings have a nice curve to their backside, sort of giving them a knife shape. They also have a long tail that comes to a point and can help differentiate them from other swifts like the chimney swift, black swift, and many swallow species that have squared-off tails or have those forked tails. And it's important that you're able to like spot these differences in, you know, tail and body shape, because a lot of times white-throated swifts are observed feeding in mixed flocks along with swallows. But usually the white-throated swifts are in much fewer numbers. So if you're in this bird's range and, you know, you look up and you see like some violet swallows or something like that, you know, don't just like be like, oh, it's just a bunch of violet swallows and write them off. Like, be sure to look pretty closely at the flock, because mixed in with them might be a few rare white-throated swifts. These are fast flying birds that are often flying really high up in the air, so it can be hard to get a close look at them. But if you do, you'll see they have a nice creamy white on their head, throat, and underbelly that gives them their common name. The rest of their body is a much more dull brown-gray color. They have really small beaks, but don't let that fool you. These birds have absolutely massive mouths that they use to gobble up prey. Check out the photo by Charlie that shows their kind of scary-looking open mouth as he photographed a swift while it was taking a sip of water from a river. If you've listened to my whippoorwill episode, you'll know that, like, you know, night jars, they have these just massive mouths. They're like pretty much vacuum cleaners to gobble up flying insect prey. And we'll talk in the evolution section. Swifts are related to nightjars, and so they have those similarly just huge mouths to hoover up flying bugs. As far as their range, they are a bird of western North America. Their range spreads from southern British Columbia down the western U.S., with the eastern border of their range around South Dakota. And then they go down into southwest New Mexico and the western parts of Texas, down into Mexico and Honduras. The northern population migrates south in the winter. Cornell has the migratory line cutting through Arizona, Southern California, and New Mexico. There's also a subspecies that is unique to southern Mexico and Honduras. Although they are migrants and a highly aerial species, they don't seem to stray outside of their range much. There are a few scattered reports of white-throated swifts turning up in Michigan, Arkansas, Ohio, Missouri. There is even one report of an extremely exhausted white-throated swift being found on a condominium balcony in April of 2009 in Navarre Beach on the western panhandle of Florida. This swift was eventually rehabilitated and released. As far as their habitat, it's really dependent on them having access to cliffs for breeding in the summer and roosting in the winter. These cliffs also need to be nearby good feeding grounds, such as meadows that support insect life. So, their scientific name is Aeronautes saxatilis. Aeronautes, this genus name, comes from two ancient Greek words for air and sailor. This is a really cool genus name. These birds are basically sailors of the air. You know, aero, air, nautes, like nautical, sailor, sea. I love this because that's exactly what I kind of pictured when I saw them flying in Big Bend. Like, they can read the winds the same way, you know, an ancient sailor could, and are just experts at maneuvering around it. Saxatilis seems to come from the Latin word of saxum, which means rock, likely referring to the nesting habits of these swifts on cliffsides. There was a little bit of naming drama with these guys. I found some older birding reports from the early 1900s, and they all list the white-throated swift as Aeronautes melanolucus, which means black-white. Apparently this is because in 1854, an ornithologist called Baird described and named this bird Aeronautes melanolucus, and his account was pretty well-known. However, a year earlier, another guy named Woodhouse had also seen and named the white-throated swift as Aeronautes saxatilis. Apparently he did a pretty crappy job at describing it. His account didn't really get widespread. But even though he did a shit job describing it, Bear did beat Woodhouse to the punch. So his scientific name stuck. So before I go into, like, you know, the breeding, feeding, you know, my usual format, I want to spend some time just marveling at the amazing physical adaptations of these birds that allows them to be masters of the air. Swifts in general are just incredible flyers. No species within the family better demonstrates this than the common swift. It sometimes spends 10 months continuously flying, eating, drinking, sleeping, and mating all while airborne. Most research on swift aerodynamics and flight physiology comes from research of the common swift, but this research applies to all swift species in general. So a lot of the studies and stuff I'm going to be referencing, they're usually looking at common swifts here. So you heard me earlier describe those long, thin, tapered wings of the swift, and these wings have a high aspect ratio. I've talked about aspect ratio on the show before a lot. Check out my Vulture episode, my Godwit episode. Generally, a high aspect ratio with long, thin wings means trading off maneuverability for increased lift. Sorry for the awkward stop there. Man, the jets are really enforced today. It's like every 2 to 5 minutes. They're doing low passes over the park here. I really wonder how, you know, these jets affect, you know, the birds, because, like, I mean, they come over, they're so loud, you can't hear anything, the birds can't call to communicate. Just for a second, I'm going to play kind of what the jets sound like through my microphone here. I hope it doesn't blow out your ears. All right, I'm sorry for that. But, I mean, that's what the birds are hearing. you know, here almost every day. It's a, you know, it's a beautiful park. It's a great swamp that provides a lot of fresh water. It supports a lot of, you know, migratory bird species as they go up and down the coast. But man, those jets are just something else. A lot of noise pollution. That's for sure. Somebody should do a research study on it. Not me. I don't have time for that. I'm busy doing this podcast. Oh, I'm not sure if the mic picked it up, but the squirrel frogs are starting to go at it. Anyway, so swifts have these long, thin wings that have a high aspect ratio. I've talked about aspect ratio on the show a lot. Check out my vulture episode and my godwit episodes. But generally, a high aspect ratio with long, thin wings means trading off maneuverability for increased lift and therefore less energy needed to stay airborne. It also means less induced drag, which is drag created by lift itself. I didn't, you know this. I dived down a lot of articles, you know, looking at this. But apparently, you know, your airplane, when it's lifting off the tarmac, the actual act of lift itself creates more drag on it. I hear a bunch of chickadees and those squirrel frogs. Also, there's another type of drag, parasitic drag. So this is drag created by the body and the wings. It's kind of a cool term, parasitic drag. Like, it means that the aircraft or the bird itself is creating drag on itself. So, I mean, if you have longer wings, that's more surface area that produces more parasitic drag. So there is a bit of trade-off between, you know, less induced drag when you have those long, thin wings, but you make more parasitic drag. But I guess you have more lift, so it's easier to stay airborne, which is a trade-off that they accept. And I really went down this rabbit hole when I was reading studies about this bird, because drag is a really interesting question in birds. You know, their feathers, they're not smooth surfaces. When you look at them under a microscope, like, they're pretty rough. I found one article describing that on a microscopic level, feathers actually resemble Velcro. You would think that they produce a lot of air turbulence and drag. For example, an ultra-performance plane, which, by the way, has, you know, long tapered wings similar to the swifts, it has super smooth sides and has a roughness height on its surface of 0.0001%, while the wings of swift have 1,000 times that roughness. This is where the aerodynamics physics really comes into play. I won't even pretend to fully understand it. But basically, the big picture, the big factor in this is something called Reynolds number. I know, totally something new for me. Oh my gosh, I just had to take a second to pause because the forest is alive right now, because there's a pause in the jets for once. Have you ever turned on a faucet and noticed that when the faucet is barely on, there's a clear, smooth stream of water, but when you crank up the water pressure, the water appears to turn white and frothy? That's actually Reynolds number in action, because Reynolds number helps define when a fluid goes from a smooth laminar flow to a rough turbulence flow. You'd expect the rough wings of the swift to produce a lot of turbulence, and they do, but luckily for them, their wings are skinny enough that all that turbulence doesn't occur until after the air has passed over them. Experiments in wind tunnels have shown that swift wings have the same high performance as the best sailplanes. Swifts also tend to fly high up in the air column, where the air is thinner, and that helps to reduce drag. Molting can be a bit of a problem for these birds because it's essential that they can always fly and stay airborne. So their approach is that of the tortoise and not of the hare. They do one molt a year during the spring and summer and replace feathers over a period of about 6 months to ensure they can always stay airborne. And another thing here, swifts, this is pretty common to almost all of them. They produce this very sticky saliva that helps them glue their nest together. And also, when I talk about their feeding, this will come into play too. Some members of the swift family build nests entirely out of saliva. You may have heard of the Asian delicacy bird nest soup before. It's exactly what it sounds like. These are nests of the white nest or black nest swift, which are harvested and sold for a soup that supposedly has many health benefits. It's pretty crazy. These birds, like, their nests, you know, like clear. It almost looks like they're made out of plastic or something like that. They make it all out of saliva. They sell for thousands of dollars by the pound, you know, worth way more than gold. It's insane. Speaking of soup, let's dive into the feeding of swifts. They feed exclusively on insects found in the air. This can be flying insects like flies, gnats, and mosquitoes, but also bees and hornets, winged ants, flying termites. Sometimes it's non-flying insects that just kind of get swooped up in air currents. And another thing too is ballooning spiders. These are spiders that, you know, distribute by kind of creating almost sails out of, web. And then they'll just like kind of let the wind carry them and carry them wherever and land them somewhere. And then, you know, hopefully it's a good place for them to make another web and get lots of bugs. This reminds me of Charlotte's Web, the cartoon at least. I don't remember the book very well, but I remember watching, you know, it in elementary school. And at the end, when the spider dies, you know, after saving Wilbur from getting the axe, you know, she dies, but she lays some eggs. I don't know who the heck she mated with to make these, but she lays some eggs, and you know, they all hatch, and they do this. They like balloon away into the wind, and as they go, they're all like, "Bye, Wilbur." So that's what I imagine. They're like, "Bye, Wilbur," flying up into the air, and then a white-throated swift is just coming down and gobbling them up. Like I said, they use these massive mouths to eat up the bugs. You know, basically, they're just hoovering them up. They are experts at locating rising air columns that concentrate and carry insects airborne. Often these are alongside cliff faces, buildings, and along the edges of storms. And I think if they're just eating for themselves, they just kind of like gobble them up and swallow them. But for sure, when they're feeding their nestlings, white-throated swifts will feed as usual, but instead of swallowing the bugs, they will store a ball of bugs called a bolus in their mouths and then bring it to their nestlings. The bolus is made up of either many small bugs or a few large ones stuck together with saliva. In a study I found that examined the insect contents of these boluses, each bolus contained an average of 100 insects. But if, you know, it was some big bugs like, you know, bees, flies, that kind of stuff, you know, there would only be like two or three. Check out the Dirty Bird Podcast Instagram and Reddit page to see pictures Charlie took of white-throated swifts with what he calls a fat lipper of a food bolus. I love that term he used because it literally looks like the swift has like a pinch of chewing tobacco or dip in its mouth. Like it's got down the lip there. It's like, yep, ding. So that's the white-throated swift saliva in action to make those food boluses. We'll also see it does use it too in its nest making. Their breeding is probably one of the coolest things about these birds. You know, they're so cool to watch when they feed, but watching them when they're doing their courtship rituals must be incredible. I've never seen it, but these accounts I'm about to go into, it's so fucking cool. So they do courtship chases. They'll call to each other repeatedly while doing the chase. The lead bird will also kind of hold its wings in a V position for several seconds during the chase. Sometimes these chases will end with an elaborate courtship fall. From descriptions I've seen, it almost appears as if the birds are fighting. And that's what a lot of like early researchers thought, is that they were two rival males fighting. And then they started to realize that, you know, it was always a male and a female that were involved in this. Basically, the male and female will collide midair, flutter for a moment, and then plunge towards the ground while locked together. It's unknown whether they actually mate while doing these falls, but certainly possible. I read an account by a guy, Percy Taverner, who observed a breeding colony over Vesoul Lake in Canada. And he writes, "They copulate in the air. At least several times I saw two meet, apparently face to face high in the air, clinging together as though embracing for a moment, through which they drop down hundreds of feet, there to separate and catch themselves on their wings." These courtship falls are particularly dramatic and death-defying because the pairs will often drop all the way down to the ground, only breaking contact and flying off in the milliseconds before they hit. Sometimes they actually do hit. There's an account from Shufelt in New Mexico in 1887 of a pair slamming into the dusty ground and appearing dazed for several seconds before fortunately flying off. Another guy, Van Tine, observed white-throated swifts at the same place as me, Emery Peak in Big Bend National Park in Texas, although the park actually wasn't founded yet when he made these observations in 1937. He didn't realize these were courtship flights. He thought that there was two rival males fighting instead. But he notes that sometimes they struck the slopes of mountains and rolled down the slope. They also likely sometimes crash into the water where they perform these courtship dives over lakes and rivers. But they appear to be pretty good swimmers. In 1982, a white-throated swift was observed swimming on Gallagher Lake in British Columbia. It held its head high above the water and used strong pumps of its flipper-like wings to propel it almost 200 feet across the lake to the shore. It was totally exhausted after this effort, though, and the kind observer, Daniel Brunton, placed it in a cardboard box overnight to rest and dry off and released it in the morning. They have been observed taking flight bass, where they will kind of slap into the water while flying. So that might also have been a cause of this particular swift becoming waterlogged from overzealous bathing. But I like to think, you know, it was doing that courtship fall and didn't pull up in time, slammed into the lake. Good thing it's a good swimmer. They will also sometimes do group displays. I saw a paper that termed these screaming parties, where large groups of swifts will pass by their nesting sites and call together several times before returning to feeding. Screaming parties. Yeah! I guess that sounds like a hardcore show or something like that. Also, a few individuals will usually take this opportunity to enter their nest. Another group display they do is called Silent Dread, and this occurs right after a screaming party, or when a group is foraging together. Silent Dread. Okay, so that's the name of the hardcore band that people go to for screaming parties. Anyway, basically in a Silent Dread display, all individuals suddenly become silent and rush off in different directions before grouping back together at a different location. This threat is thought to be due to them, you know, thinking that there's a supposed threat, like, you know, a peregrine falcon or a hawk, you know, something like that. But it hasn't been totally confirmed yet. They nest in crevices and cliff faces that are protected from the elements and also out of reach of predators. I read a couple of accounts from admiring but frustrated 18th and 19th century ornithologists who talk about how difficult it is to collect their eggs and nest high up in the crumbling, dangerous cliffs. They will sometimes be found nesting in colonies, especially if prime nesting crevices are rare. If they find a good spot, colonies may return to it year after year. One site in the Toyaba Range in Nevada was documented being used over 50 years. They also seem to have strong pair bonds, and pairs nesting together year after year have been documented. They will also nest in man-made structures like buildings, bridges, and overpasses that provide similar conditions to cliff faces. And while it's unknown if they, you know, mate during that dramatic courtship dive, they have been observed mating on their nest sites too. Their nest is a shallow cup-shaped nest, and they use moss, bark, and plant material, all glued together with that wonderful sticky saliva. They also seem to put a lot of downy feathers. Some of the pictures of collected nests that I saw looked super fluffy and comfy. While their secluded cliffs may be protected from many predators, they aren't safe from mites. From the accounts of nest collectors that I read, the soft downy nests were teeming with mites when collected. Since their nests are really inaccessible and difficult to observe, a lot of information on their incubation period and breeding behaviors is unknown, but it's thought that they only raise one brood per year. Pretty much the only in-depth observation of their breeding I could find was by this guy Charles Collins in Southern California. He actually studied white-throated swifts nesting inside highway overpasses using the drainage pipes like tunnels. As evidence to how close to humanity these birds were, he observed cellophane being used in the nest construction alongside the more usual feathers and plant material. But nesting next to humans does have its deadly consequences too. He did observe one swift nestling that was found dead tangled in string. The nest he found had an average of 2 to 5 white eggs. It's unknown exactly how long eggs are brooded for one average hatchling, but the estimated amount was 24 days. Upon hatching, the chicks are blind, pink, and naked. They also have a prominent egg tooth, which is a sharp projection on their bill that helps them peck out of the egg. And this egg tooth kind of gives them a buck tooth-like appearance when they first emerge. By day 8, their eyes have opened and their first feathers start to emerge. By around day 22, these feathers have fully emerged and then open up to form a fluffy layer around the nestlings. It takes a full 40 days for feathers to approach being fully formed and adult-like. So these are pretty long nesting birds, you know, like, you know, we talk about like our Carolina wren, you know, it's 2 weeks to hatch, 2 weeks as nestling, and then it's out of there. It's incredible that these guys, you know, hatch and, you know, they're in there for over a month before they're ready to leave. I guess that's the benefit of, you know, nesting in a place that's not really accessible to predators. Like, you can spend some time in there chilling, growing slowly, letting your parents bring you some food boluses that they got like a lip in their mouth. In the wintertime, these birds are still very social, if not more so, actually. They'll find caves and abandoned buildings to roost in at night. Individuals at these roosts can number in the hundreds. They will also do chase flights even in the winter, and since there's more individuals in one place, there's a lot of chasing going on. None of it ends in those courtship dives, though. It's kind of just like maybe some practice or foreplay before the big event comes in the spring. From observations, they appear to be pretty long-lived birds for their size and experience low rates of adult mortality. One last really interesting breeding fact on these guys. In a highway overpass in Sacramento, California, white-throated swifts and western purple martins were observed using the same overpass for breeding. In fact, they were observed even going into the same drainage holes. This got researchers interested, and when they started looking in the holes, they found some cases where both white-throated swifts and purple martins were nesting near each other. This is pretty odd, because you'd never catch two swift or two martins, you know, in the same hole. But some of these holes contained a purple martin and a white-throated swift. When they looked at the martin nests, they even found 3 instances of white-throated nestlings in purple martin nests. This is termed brood parasitism. You know, it's a famous strategy of the brown-headed cowbird, and also employed by other birds like cuckoos. It's unclear whether this was intentional, or just due to, you know, a white-throated nestling kind of wandering into the wrong nest. So, like, you know, they only found 3 cases of this. One of them was, you know, there were 2 nests basically right near each other, so it's very plausible that a nestling could have, you know, fallen out of one nest and climbed back in the other, and now I'm a purple martin, I guess. The other 2, there were no white-throated swift nests in the hole, but, like, you know, the researcher did say, hey, you know, we didn't like explore it super thoroughly. There could have been one hiding, or one could have been, you know, started in there but destroyed, or they had already finished, you know, fledging or something like that. So it's unclear whether it was intentional, whether the white-throated swifts were like, oh man, we can pull one off on these purple martins, get them to, you know, raise one of our eggs. But still, very, very interesting. All right, let's talk about their vocalizations. I read a great article by Florence Bailey in 1907. She described white-throated swifts she observed nesting in the historic ruins of the San Juan Capistrano Mission in California. She wrote, "Their wild, shrieked-out notes recalled canyons walled with rock in the depths of the mountains." I really like that description because, I mean, I don't know, it just kind of captures both the sound and then also the environment you usually find them in. My handy-dandy National Geographic bird book also has this. It says, "When feeding, it may come near the ground to fly about with ordinary speed, but at other times darts about high overhead uttering shrill, high-pitched laughing calls." And while white-throated swifts don't do this, I do want to mention this in the vocalization section. I found this cool fact about a tribe within the true swift family called the swiftlets. I'll talk about them a little bit later in the evolution section. But certain species of them nest primarily in caves in the dark, and they have actually evolved an echolocation ability. That's freaking cool. There's only one other bird that does it, the oil bird. The swiftlets and oil birds are the only ones that do this. So cool that they can use echolocation. And they both evolved it independently, it seems, too. I've always wondered this when I watch swifts, you know, because, like, their chirps do sound like, you know, radar pinging from a sub in Hunt for Red October or something like that. So I've always watched them and be like, man, are they using echolocation to, you know, find those bugs? But, you know, no, they're not. They're using, you know, sight, and then also they're reading the air currents to know where bugs are probably going to be located at. All right, folks, home stretch here. Let's talk about their evolution and also their population numbers. So this is the big evolutionary surprise of the episode. Swifts are not closely related to swallows. I know, even though they look and behave super alike, this is a case of convergent evolution. The actual closest relative to swifts is, wait for it, hummingbirds. Yes, I know, that's crazy. Hummingbirds and swifts belong to the order Apodiformes. Owlet nightjars are a sister taxon to the Apodiformes. Owlet nightjars are nocturnal species native to Australasia. I've talked a bit about the evolution of this whole group of birds in my whippoorwill episode. And if you actually look just a few more splits up in the evolutionary tree, you know, from hummingbirds and swifts, you'll see that big-mouthed birds like frogmouse, potos, nightjars, like the whippoorwill, and oil birds are, you know, all like kind of in a group together. So, you know, that big mouth on the swifts, like, you know, that comes from an ancient ancestor. But the hummingbird is kind of, you know, the odd bird out here with its little, you know, long beak and everything like that. I'm sure I'll do a hummingbird episode one day, and yes, I will talk all about the very intricate and cool hummingbird evolution. But another thing you'll notice is that all these birds that I just mentioned, you know, the frogmouse, the nightjars, the oil birds, they're all nocturnal. So, you know, what the heck? Why are the hummingbird and the swifts, why are they, you know, diurnal species? There's actually a lot of evolutionary debate about this, about whether the ancestral species for all these birds was nocturnal, and then the ancestor to the Apodiformes group became diurnal and went on to form the hummingbird, swift, and swiftlets. Another theory is that each group became nocturnal independently. So Occam's razor, you know, the theory that the most, you know, simplest explanation is the right one, would argue that the first theory is correct, that this, you know, evolved from a nocturnal ancestor and then they became diurnal, you know, again, would be the correct one, because it seems pretty unlikely that, you know, dark activity would evolve four separate times independently. But this would mean that there's a millions of years gap between Apodiformes, you know, daytime birds, and their last daytime ancestor, with all these nocturnal species in between. You would expect that during that time frame, they would have lost a lot of the adaptations for their eyesight. And I mean, you know, daylight, like, vision is a very complicated thing. So, like, you know, losing that over millions of years and then evolving it back, that seems even less plausible than evolving nocturnal activity for independently separate times. So that's kind of the big debate here is, did the ancestor become nocturnal? For millions of years, it was just, you know, these nocturnal birds. And then all of a sudden, you know, one of them like, oh, I'm going back out in the daytime. And like its eyes were just able to adapt to it. Or was the common ancestor, you know, a diurnal, a daytime species, and then just four separate times it independently became nocturnal to form, you know, the oil birds, the nightjars, the potos? It's a question that has no clear answer right now. It could be that eyesight is just so hardwired into birds that maybe these genes can just easily be, you know, switched back on. Or becoming, you know, daytime to nighttime could just be easier than we think. So no clear answer on that yet, but something cool to think about. Back to Autopodiform as birds, though. They split into three families, Trochilidae, which contains the hummingbirds, Hemiprocnidae, which contains four species of kind of crazy-looking swift birds called the tree swifts, and the true swift family of Apodidae. The first fossils for this family pop up in England, Denmark, and Germany, and date from the early to middle Eocene, about 55 to 40 million years ago. One of these fossil birds, called Scaniocypsilus, had shorter and less specialized wings than modern-day swifts, showing it had not yet evolved the long, thin, super-efficient wings of modern-day swifts, and probably wasn't able to maintain flight as long. It also had shorter legs and toes. Modern-day tree swifts and hummingbirds have similarly short legs and toes, so it's thought that the common ancestor for Apodiformes also had these short legs. You know, short legs, short toes, these are fine if you're just like a tree perching bird, you know, perching on like twigs and branches and things like that. But if you're a swift that's, you know, perching on tree cliffs or like you're nesting inside of dead hollow trees, you need longer legs and pretty strong toes to be able to cling to those vertical surfaces. So the common ancestor for Apodiformes likely was, you know, perching on tree branches and things like that, and not a cavity nester or a cliff face nester. Another fossil from the Green River Formation of Wyoming, dating to 50.6 million years ago, called Eocypsilus roe, also looks like a cross between a hummingbird and a swift. It has a swift-like beak, it has long legs, and wings that aren't especially adapted to swift soaring flight or hummingbird hovering. It does have that small body size, though, that's common to all Apodiformes birds, weighing only 30 grams. So it seems like the common ancestor of these birds was, you know, very small in body size, was likely tree perching, and then, of course, later on, as the swift family began to form, the legs got longer, the toes got longer, it started nesting inside of cavities or caves. You'll notice all these fossils appear to come from Europe and America, so a northern hemisphere origin for the order has been proposed. The major clades within the true swift Apodidae family started to be present about 16 to 19 million years ago, and they appear to have spread pretty much all over the world pretty quickly, as evidenced by fossils popping up in New Zealand. There are actually over 100 swift and swiftlet species, and the taxonomy of them is always changing. as usual, researching the evolution of these was super difficult. You know, I'd read one article from the 1980s and then, you know, get refuted by one from the 1990s, and then in the 2000s they're doing genetic data, and it's like, nope, all that's out the window. So anyway, you know, originally they were separated on morphological characteristics like configurations of their toes or difference in their bones. Apparently there's also a big split in the family between some members having two carotid arteries and other members having only one carotid artery. And so that was used to separate them in the past too. DNA evidence gives some clarification, but just when taxonomists thought they were starting to get a grip on the family, it was discovered that some species of swiftlets can use echolocation, and this threw everything into debate, because not all swiftlets use echolocation. So they're like, well, when did this evolve? Is this a common, you know, from a common ancestor? Did this evolve independently? So there's just tons of articles about that. But anyway, based on the papers I've read, this is my understanding of how the relationships among the swift shake out, focusing on our white-throated swift. Right now, there are two main subfamilies of swifts that split into four major tribes. The first subfamily is Cypsilodinae, that contains the sole Cypsilodinae tribe. This tribe contains only New World swifts, most of which reside in South America. And while it contains the white-chinned swift, it does not contain our white-throated swift. The other subfamily, Apodinae, contains three tribes. The Colocalinae tribe, that contains the swiftlets, some of which have that echolocation ability. The tribe Chaturinae, which contains the needle-tailed swifts, and these swifts have a worldwide distribution. And finally, the creatively named Apodinae tribe, which is called the typical Swifts and almost seems like a everybody else Swift tribe. This is what our white-throated Swift belongs to. From what I could tell from genetic evidence, most studies focus on Old World Swifts and on the Swiftlets. So didn't have much there on our white-throated Swift. I'm using a paper from the journal Molecular Phylogenetics of Evolution from 2003. They used some cytochrome B analysis, and they suggested that the Swiftlet tribe was the most recent among the Apodinae subfamily, while the other two tribes, Chaturinae and Apodinae, have more ancient origins. And when I was trying to find, like, you know, the phylogenetical tree, I'm not even using the One Zoom Tree of Life anymore. I have no idea where their evidence comes from. But anyway, I only found one paper, you know, using DNA evidence and showing a phylogeny tree, you know, showing the genus Arenades that, you know, remember our white-throated swift belongs to. But it was a article referenced within another article. I couldn't find the original article. It's called, authored by Bian Kalana et al., 2017. Could not find it. If anybody else finds it, please let me know. It showed a sort of clade formed by the genus Arenades, Tacornis, and Panipetilla. Tacornis contains three South American palm swift species, and Panipetilla contains just two swallow-tailed swift species that live in Middle and South America. These two genuses are pretty geographically close, and it's not surprising that they end up being sister genuses on the genetic analysis, while Arenades branches off a little earlier than their split. The Arenates genus contains two other species, the white-tipped swift and the Andean swift. Both of these reside in South America, so the white-throated swift is the bit of the oddball in this clade with its North American home. I'm sorry I don't have more information about swift evolution, like where geographically they likely evolved and diverged and the factors that caused splits in the family. Really, all I can say overall is based on fossil evidence, the family Apodiformes likely had a northern hemisphere origin, where a small-bodied hummingbird and swift hybrid differentiated and progressively got smaller beak, longer legs, and more thin and longer wings to form the ancestor of the swift species. Due to their amazing flying abilities, they likely quickly spread across the globe, filling in new niches and diversifying wherever they ended up, creating lots of species and lots of headaches for taxonomists later on down the road. Our white-throated swift is part of the typical swift tribe, but shares a clade with a few other swifts, who almost entirely reside within South America. So, I'm gonna go out on a limb here, but I think that the origins of the white-throated swift likely came from South or Middle America. And then when they came to North America, it became its own distinct species, as it specialized on breeding on the steep canyon walls of the American West. Of course, it's not the only swift species in North America. There's, you know, other swift species in North America that I didn't really dive into, you know, their evolutionary relationship, but that's what I'm hypothesizing here, is that the white-throated swift's genetic origins lie in South America, and then it, you know, came up here to North America. So, if you know more about swift evolution than me, please, please, please write in and correct me. This was definitely something I tried to research pretty hard. It was difficult, and I did the best I can. But I hope that's informational for you guys. And hey, the real big fact is that they are related to hummingbirds, which is so freaking cool. All right, our last fact of the show here is that while white-throated swifts are very difficult birds to track and count, the population is estimated at 3.2 million, which is, I mean, that's pretty good. That's a pretty big population. I'm happy with that. They are declining as much as 50% from 1968. Pesticides are thought to really have, you know, done an impact on them, and habitat loss. Remember, these guys, like, even if they find cliffs that are suitable for them to breed in, there has to be, you know, a meadow or something nearby that they're able to feed in, that they're able to get insect prey in. I saw accounts from, like, the Sierra Nevada, especially, like, there will be no white-throated swifts at all. And then, even though there's, like, plenty of suitable breeding habitat, and then there's, like, one meadow in, like, one little valley. And, like, that's where the white-throated swifts are. So it's really important that they have access to insects, that these insects aren't getting killed with pesticides, and that they also have breeding habitat nearby. So some pretty specific habitat requirements. It looks like some man-made structures are also providing some habitat for them. But again, you know, there's risks of being in close proximity to humans. All right. Well, that's my episode on white-throated swifts. I hope you guys enjoyed it. Write in, write reviews, buy some t-shirts, let me know if you want some free stickers, and as always, stay dirty, fellow birdies.
Dirty Bird Podcast is brought to you by me, John, with my rotating panel of guests and co-hosts. Thanks for being on the show, everybody. The Dirty Bird theme song is by Ricky Pistone. Check out his groovy and hilarious music videos on YouTube. The outro music you're listening to right now is a song, New York Redneck, by the Sidewalk Slammers. Check them out wherever you get your music. The Dirty Bird Podcast logo is by the very talented TJ Ranosky. And of course, a shout out to my beautiful wife, Lauren, who created my original logo. Check out the show notes for this episode for a full list of credits for any bird calls or sounds used in the episode. Thanks for listening.
Coming back, Tim's on the ground in the concrete jungle. I might get into a little rumble.